Translation. Then the thread ceremony for the twice-born was inaugurated, as were the rules to be followed for at least 1 year after acceptance of the Vedas, rules for observing complete abstinence from sex life, vocations in terms of Vedic injunctions, various professional duties in household life, and the method of maintaining a livelihood without anyone's cooperation by picking up rejected grains. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. During student life, the brahmacharis were given full instructions about the importance of the human form of life. Thus, the basic education was designed to encourage the student in becoming free from family encumbrances. Only students unable to accept such a vow in life were allowed to go home and marry a suitable wife. Otherwise, the student would remain a permanent brahmachari, observing complete abstinence from sex life for his whole life. It all depended on the quality of the student's training. We had the opportunity to meet an avowed brahmachari. In the personality of our spiritual master, Om Vishnupad Sri Srimad Bhaktisiddhanta Goswami Maharaj. Such a great soul is called a Naishtika Brahmachari. Om Agyana Tamanandasya Janan Jana Shalakaya Chakshural Mitamina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasnaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swamin Itinamine Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gaudavani Pracharni Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschacha Desha Tarini. little tricky preparing for this class, and it's the kind of trickiness that I come across a few times in the third canto particularly. And that is due to my limited Sanskrit knowledge, try to marry up the word meanings with the translation. And it's good to know. It's good to know, I think, historically, why that may be the case, or is the case in certain verses. That when Srila Prabhupada was doing this third canto, he was in effect taking the translations from the Gita Press Srimad Bhagavatam. And if indeed you can download that copy and you can see it for yourself, this is a clear word for word, just a copy, cut and paste. So in the Gita Press version, Bhagavatam, it has the Devanagari text, a number of verses together, and then it gives you a translation of each verse. It doesn't give you a word-for-word connection, how you get there. So it seems that the translator was understanding things in certain context that aren't necessarily clear from the word for word, if I may put it that way. What we do know is that this verse, starting from this first half, is about brahmachari. This is a continuation of the explanation of the four social orders. The first half is about brahmachari. Second half is about grihastha life. Griha is there clearly. And the next verse, next verse we're coming to is about vanaprastas and sannyasis. So it's a kind of a sequence. So the first part of the verse is talking about brahmacharis. And very significantly, the first thing mentioned there is Savitram, which is the thread ceremony. And this is the Gayatri Mantra. So what it's pointing out is that if you want to establish society, the first thing you have to direct it towards is initiation. And in the Vedic culture, three quarters of the society would have Gayatri Mantra. Savitram is part of the Gayatri Mantra. Om Bhur Bhava Swa Tat Savitur is there. It means the sun. Meditating on the sun is also a reflection of Lord Vishnu. It's described in the fifth canto, chapter 20, text 5. Prabhupada Purport mentions there, or the verse mentioned there, that the sun is a reflection of Lord Vishnu. So when you're meditating on the sun, in effect, you're looking at Lord Vishnu, but it's reflection. That's one way of understanding it. So it's kind of quite a direct meditation on the Supreme Lord. So all the members of society, three quarters of the members of society, would have this initiation process. And another verse is, this is from the fifth canto, chapter 22, text 4, worship Lord Narayan, who is situated as the sun god. So the Gayatri Mantra, when you're meditating on the Gayatri Mantra, you're in effect meditating on the Supreme Lord. You may recall a few days ago, can't remember it was, when Banu Swami Maharaj was giving class. He gave a very elaborate historical contextual explanation of initiation, Gayatri Mantra, first initiation, second initiation. It was very elaborate. I won't even attempt to repeat what he said, but very highly recommended class, listen to get the whole context and also the historical context of why we have a division between first initiation and second initiation. But at least in the Vedic system, there was the thread ceremony. You'd be given the Gayatri Mantra, and there was a thread. I understand that different varnas would have different numbers of strings on their thread. Don't know where all that comes from, but that's what I've heard. Just a little interesting side detail there. So the first thing is the whole society is focusing on a particular thing. It's interesting because here we're talking about Brahmacharya life, but there's been a few problems so far in this verse, in this chapter about Brahmacharya life. And because Lord Brahma, you know, suddenly he's got this great responsibility to fill the universe with progeny. He's got to completely fill it up. And his first children were the four Kumaras. Nah, not going to get married. Not going to help you in that. So you got a bit frustrated. You got to be anxious about his business to create progeny, and the first children he produced, they weren't interested. Anyway, so the four Kumaras made that choice. And then he got very angry, and then Lord Shiva was manifested. Anyway, so there was a whole episode there. Lord Shiva produced all the children, were creating great disturbance, and then he sent him in the forest to meditate. But the whole thing about this verse is creation of the Kumaras and others. It's about creating, it's about populating the universe. So you want people to play an active role in that. And now we're hearing the first part of the societal, creating a society, is to teach people no progeny. Don't have children. Be spiritual. So the whole Vedic culture is about that direction, is to people focusing that the real goal of life is spiritual. It's not material. But society needs generation of population. So to create good population, you need good quality of people. And therefore you have to instill in them that actually sex isn't the goal of life. To create a good population where you've got lots of people being born, you have to teach people that sex enjoyment is not the goal of life. The real goal of life is Brahman, which is the Vedas. It is to understand Krishna, to understand yourself, to understand the soul, to understand the difference between matter and spirit. So the first thing you do is aiming towards a initiation, this Brahman thread, which requires a certain standard of life. In fact, when we join the Hare Krishna movement, we hear it very quickly, 4 Acres of Principles. No illicit sex, no meat eating, no gambling. What's the further one? No alcohol, no intoxication. We hear about these things. So to get initiated, there has to be a period of time of sexual control, a period of celibacy. Interesting here, this word brihat has been translated as complete abstinence from sex life. But if you look, I looked at three different Sanskrit dictionaries, and nowhere does the word brihat translate as that. Brihat means big, great. It's like we said, we call it the familiar with the Brihat Madonga. The Madonga you can hear in the street, but the Brihat Madonga is what is the printing press for publishing our books. So it's making a big noise. But you can imagine that, and actually this is the context that I understand it, and certainly the translator seems to have, is also, and Prabhupada's purport is depicting that this brihat means that powerful, major decision of abstinence from sex life, complete abstinence from sex life. Very, very hard today to kind of relate with this, because from the very moment of birth, practically speaking, as soon as you become conscious, you become aware of the urges and the propaganda and the encouragement for not abstinence, the non-abstinence. And somehow that those who are abstaining are classed as lower people in society. The heroes, the people of the day, are those who are powerful in sex life. So in the Vedic culture, very much opposite. They're the heroes, the powerful, the best of society were those who were powerfully abstaining from sex life. So brahmacharya life, these are the key things. It's about getting initiated, getting that upanayana, that thread ceremony, and to become fixed in the Vedas, and to be able to control your senses. And most of us who spent, when you become an ashram resident or a temple resident, for a certain period of time, you are obliged to be a temple resident to engage in, or not engage in, but to engage in abstinence, to consciously abstain from not just physical action, but also the cultivation of sexual interaction. And we know ourselves that when we have undergone that, there's a certain peacefulness that you get. People in society are agitated by pursuing the sexual interactions. But when you live a life of abstinence and consciously disciplining yourself to be abstain from it, then there's a certain peacefulness in your mind and senses that then allow you to really absorb yourself in the study of the Vedas. So this brahmacharya life is the foundation of society. Interesting, this word prajapatyam is interesting because it here has been, the word for word is to execute the vow for 1 year. Now I think, another again, in a kind of ISKCON historical context, I think what happens is, what happened was, when the translation was there, the Sanskrit editors had to marry it up. Because if you go to the book it was referred to, the Gita Press, Bhagavatam, you don't find a word for word. You get a translation. So the Sanskrit editors had to combine the two. And that was predominantly by Pradyumna and maybe others. So there's a translation, and how do you marry it up? But if you do, if you're ever going to give a class, I encourage you to look at the Sanskrit words and try to understand what it means. And then you'll see the dilemma sometimes there. Especially, particularly, I've noticed it in the third canto. Other cantos, not so much, but certainly I've come across a number of verses that are really quite perplexing in that regard. But it all seems to kind of become clear. This is about brahmacharya life. But this word prajapatyam is interesting because the word praja means people. It means offspring. Pacha means, again, it means offspring. This word is about prajapati. The prajapatis are those who are tasked with populating the universe. So what's that got to do with brahmacharis? Well, I think it's very relevant in a sense that when you have good quality people being produced in society, they will be able to produce good quality children. The word prajapati is also interesting. Again, it's the contrast here. This is a vow of celibacy taken for 1 year. At the same time, it means the generative energy, the procreative energy. In other words, these brahmachari, they're not some or other, you could say, sexually defunct or sexually weak. They are fully potent people, but they are controlling that generative energy. They're channeling it for intellect, for power. The word prajapati also means, just two sentences I came across, father gives the daughter to the bridegroom without receiving any present from him. There was no dowry. Prajapati marriage, who married after the groom's family approached the bride's family. So again, there's something going on there. There's an active endeavor to get somebody married. The father gives a daughter to a family, or the groom's family approaches the bride's family. Two different ways of perceiving it. My wife would tell me, my wife's from a South Indian traditional family in Savaga, and she was recalling this was their system, that the boy's family would go with the boy to the girl's family, and there'd be some kind of, you know, they'd bring the tea out or something, or she would see the boy, and the boy would see her, and then from that they would decide whether there's anything to kind of go on. So there's very kind of control system there. So this is, I think, I take this, this is what this, for me, this verse means, that it's not a free-for-all situation. It's an organized, orchestrated system. But it's about progeny. It's about generating a good society. I remember another historical concept which you never see anymore, and it was quite extraordinary. There was a, when I was in the temple here, some of our temple leaders at the time thought it was good. He thought it was their role as a kind of fatherly figure to matchmake. Sorry, Cole. In a pen, he remembers this, but in a couple of days or something like that, it was like four or five different couples were paired together. He's a big Sankirtan devotee, she's a big Sankirtan devotee, that'll do. It was kind of, it was a bit like that. It's, I don't know how it was, just sent a bit ad hoc, it seemed. Anyway, in a period of a day or so, there's like five different couples suddenly associating to be married, you could say. I think most of them actually stayed together, actually, as I recall. Some didn't work out, but some are still married to this day by that system of kind of organizing. In my case, I didn't just I kind of came to a point in my life. I was a benefiting from a brahmachari for 3 or 4 years. Obviously, I wasn't a brahmachari before I joined the movement. I joined about when I was 21, for 3 years or so, I was living in a brahmachari, and at some point it was time to get married again. And then someone suggested some possibilities, and then Jaya Chovishyan kicked in and became attached. And I'm married to my wife to this day, many, many years later. Happily married to this day. So this is the system, that you train people in control, initiation, meditating on Krishna every day. Trisandhyam Brahma initiation means three points a day at each junction of the day. Sandhya means a junction between night and day, between morning and afternoon, between day and night. Those three junctions, you do this meditation. So it's about discipline of the mind and thinking about what's really important in life. And it's about studying the Vedas and controlling those urges. So if you put he with she, you get progeny. So society, if you want to create more population, you get people married, and automatically, you could say, children will come. And then as soon as the children, there's that nice verse, which, well, I like to quote often, Griha Kshetra Sutta Apta Vritair. That sometimes this is kind of a verse that's quoted to show how contaminating or complicating material life is, as not an encouragement for it. Griha means house. Again, the word is there, griha, household life. We're talking about how, now we're coming, the second part of the verse is talking about householders, those who live in a house. Griha Kshetra means a field. So in a more kind of rural setting, then literally means a field. You've got a field of, you grow something, you have something in a field. In our setting, city setting, it means you do something, some activity, some field of activity to create some revenue, some income. Griha Kshetra Sutta, then there's children. So that comes third. House, job, work, then children. Sometimes in society today it's a bit upside down. Griha Kshetra Sutta Apta Vritera. And the next two is some kind of social interchange. You have to have some kind of social life. You got to take your wife places. You've got to take your children places. Nowadays it means airplanes. It means car. It means transportation. And you have to be able to accumulate assets, gold, saris, clothing, again, cars, furniture. How you need to have all these different things. This is what society means. One time someone was complaining to Srila Prabhupada about household life. Was finding it a little cumbersome. And Prabhupada said, what do you think it means? It means this. It means Griha Kshetra Sutta Apta Vritera. So you have to put these things in place. You have to take provision for these things. Interesting, yesterday when Urmila Prabhu was giving class, she mentioned this, that in our brahmacharya ashrams or in our temple training, we don't necessarily train people to be grihasthas. We don't train people, she mentioned, we don't train people for their vocation. We train people to get knowledge. And then she commented how the importance is that we should have these Varnasham colleges. And Srila Prabhupada wanted a Varnasham college with every temple. So we need to teach people how to be responsible householders. And also for us as a missionary, we need to teach people how to be part of the mission as householders. And I think I would repeat more, I think sometimes that's not always there. We're not leaving the ashram period fully equipped of taking responsibility for the mission in a particular way. We have to work it out ourselves. It's not that we're equipped for it. I remember many years ago, I was listening to a radio interview about seminaries, Christian seminaries. And they had a system that they were training a certain number of priests to fit a certain number of congregations, certain number of churches. So they had a target. We train a certain number of people, and those people go and look after these congregations. So sometimes we don't necessarily currently have that systematic methodological training that people go out ready to run a namahata, ready to open a temple, ready to look after a congregation, ready to nurture people. People have to find their own way. So here, now we're getting to the householder ashram. And some other words are mentioned there. I'm going to come to Varta last, but I'll go to the other ones. And it talks about different ways that you basically make a living. It's not making a distinction here. It's not categorizing, for example, if you want to know more details about the different ways of livelihood, you need to go to the seventh canto, where it's more detailed described. The duties of a kshatriya, duties of a brahmana, duties of a vaishya, duties of a shudra, duties of a woman, all the different things there are described in the seventh canto of the Bhagavatam. But here it just gives you a kind of general summary. Sanchaya means collecting, gathering. What's interesting also is that there's no social evolution. What it's saying categorically, verse after verse, this universe, as we're hearing, Lord Brahma is unfolding. He's re-establishing a well-seasoned path, you could say, of what the universe looks like and its various characteristics. It's not you just chuck a bunch of people into the world and say, okay, work it out. No, there's something inherently there. So the different types of ways you can make a living, it's already, you could say, written in the universal system. And one of the systems is somehow that you do some collecting. One of the commentaries was that, for example, means officiating at a sacrificial performance. So if you're a priest in a sacrificial performance, you will receive some reward in some way. Maybe you might get donated gold. Maybe you might get donated cows. Maybe you might be donated something else as a way to make up your living. But the word ksantia means collecting, gathering, accumulation. So I thought, how do we relate with that now? If you were to make your living from gathering and accumulating, what would you do? How would you do that today? Oil paintings. Sell paintings. You're gathering. Sounds more like a trade, though, to me. Because someone's going to paint it, you're buying a painting, you're selling it to someone else. Interesting. Any other thoughts on it? You've got to live by gathering and collecting. Of course, we might say someone's doing the collections. They're shaking it in. I don't think it means that. There's something more natural that's been described here. Later, the next verse, we're going to hear about the vanaprastas. And they're living off fruits. But they're not grihastas. This is grihastas. So what are they doing? Maybe they're also gathering fruits. What was it? Kulavesha Sridhar? What was he selling? Banana leaves. So he's gathering banana leaves and selling them. But this is a very difficult thing to do. How would you make a living like that? What could you gather that you could sell? Fruit? I'll tell you, if you can go around this whole country and you can gather tons and tons and tons of fruit that nobody wants. So that's one way you may consider doing something like that. Difficult. Most of these things are difficult. Nowadays, people just get a job. In this time, 3/4 of the society were independently financed. They had their own source of income, one way or the other. And one segment of the society were dependent on the other three for their livelihood. Nowadays, it seems to flip the other way. Hardly anyone is independently financed. That's Sanjaya. The next one is Salina. Living on whatever may be got without asking. In the 7th canto, 11th chapter, where you can find more of these things, it's a livelihood achieved without effort. Taking alms without begging. How would you do that? How would you do that? I thought maybe you're living off your inheritance. Maybe that's what it means. Somewhere out there, you're just there. And, I mean, that's pretty difficult. For example, if you want to gather money, you would not sit in the forest. I mean, nowadays, you find people sitting on the street corners or in the street. I remember I went to Manchester. And I was quite surprised that every 20 metres, there was somebody sitting on the side of the road with a cup. It was almost like this, like territory, 20 metres, 20 metres, 20 metres, 20 metres, 20 metres. So they have a system, but they're asking for something. So they're not. This is not like that. They're making a provision. I'm sitting in a... And actually, Srila Prabhupada, we recall that when he was living in Vrindavan, for some time, he was doing something like that. He was sitting outside the temple when he was living as a vanaprastha, and just people would come by and put money in his cup. Very difficult to live like that. But somehow this is what he's talking about. Very, very complex thing. The other one is, next one is siloncha, which means living on food grains found scattered and gleaned from fields after the harvest or from a grain market. Well, what do they call it? There's a certain name for it now. What do they call it? Where people live out of bins? Not literally out of bins, but they live off things that are being thrown away. I mean, in one sense, we have our food for all, we have gratitude. They're kind of one sense living on one sense food grains or food things that people are not using. Nowadays, it'd be very difficult to go into someone's field after they harvested and not find some agitation from the farmer if you're sort of gleaning the grains that get left behind. So very difficult things for us to comprehend with those. So the other one, Varta, which is the first one, is more easy for us to relate with. Varta means the normal things that we are aware of, Krishi Gorakshivaniam, Vaishya Karma Sabhavajam. These are things that we're more understand and get ahead around. Agriculture, care protection, trade. Another one is called banking. These are kind of four things that are described there. Again, another problem for us. And the reason why, and I'm going to talk about a little bit because of something that occupies my mind quite a bit, is agriculture. If you wanted to make your living from agriculture, how would you do it and could you do it? In our movement, there are not many people who are living from agriculture. There are many people who are growing things. In fact, there's a very active WhatsApp group where lots of householders, I don't know, maybe 100 or more in this country are interfacing, and they're growing something. They're growing flour, they're growing vegetables, they're growing fruits. But they're not making a living from it. They're making their money from some other means. In our movement, there are very few devotees who make their living from agriculture. There's a devotee in Sweden called Anjaneya. I may mention his name because he lives very simply. He earned enough money to go to India every year. He was able to build a house. And he grows vegetables. He has a greenhouse. He has a couple of acres of land. And then he sells his produce at a market in Stockholm. And he'll sell some of his produce to restaurants. And like everywhere else, for example, if you wanted to calculate here, it's an issue even here because at our farm, they're growing all this produce, but then in the winter, there's not much produce. So normally, if you want to make a business all year round of selling organic produce, you have to buy your organic produce from someone else that's shipping it in from another country. Another devotee who's making a living from agriculture is in Italy, and they make soaps, they make honey products, they make candles, they sell vegetables, they grow grains, they sell flour and bread, a whole spectrum of things, and again, they have a market stall. So it is possible, but you can see it doesn't capture most people's attention. There's a lot of hard work going into it. It's much easier nowadays for people just to get a job. Work for someone, get a salary, but it feels different. When you work for yourself, there's a strength. There's something that you feel fundamentally more empowered by than having to satisfy a boss. So previously, 3/4 of society were like that. They weren't dependent on anybody else. But nowadays, most of society are dependent on someone else to provide work for them. Another area of real-life social problem is if you want to make your livelihood from cow protection, how would you do it? For example, cows need land and they need buildings. An acre of land further afield, you might pay £10,000 an acre. If you're going to buy it around here, you're going to pay £20,000 an acre. Each cow, self-sufficiently, needs 2.5 acres. So it's £25,000 to £50,000 an acre for one cow. That's a lot of money. And therefore, I mean, there are jobs, if I may use the word, for cow protectors. There are some goshalas that need cow protectors. For example, in Sweden right now, little advertisement, they're looking for a goshala manager to assist their goshala in Sweden. Here at the manor, there's a number of devotees employed to help with the cows. They milk the cows, they work the bulls, they do administration, they take care of the guests, they look after the volunteers. There are so many cow protection related activities. There are currently some devotees around the world who are living off cow protection. There are many people around the world who have cows, thousands, thousands all over the world, but they're not protecting their cows. They don't look after the children of the cows. At some point, they give them away, sell them, they get killed everywhere in the world. So for us, as Veda followers, we don't kill our cows. We make sure the cows are protected for their whole life, which means there's a different economics that's there. So there are some devotees who do it, but it's unsure what will happen in the future. And the reason is because of succession. Who takes over? You're inspired. You've got a great idea. You've got a family business. I'm going to pass it down to my kids. And the kids get up and they think, nah, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do something else. Many years ago, there was a farm presenter called, I can't remember his name now, but he came here. He was looking at our Goshella, interviewed my wife, interviewed me about the farm. Hanson, it's called. Countryfile. And he reported recently that he's giving up farming now because his children are going a different direction. So this is a difficulty. If you start off with cow protection, who carries on your great, wonderful idea? So I'm not, although it's the Vedic system, it's the Vedic model, is the model that Srila Prabhupada talks about, it's very, very difficult because of succession. Who will carry on your cow protection once you get sick, you retire, you die? What happens then? So it's much better I promote, we do it as a society, the ISKCON society. For example, the Goshal here has been here since 1973. It's still functioning, it's thriving, it's pulsating. People are coming, people are going, but there's a core activities that are going on every day. So this model to me seems much more sustainable because it's not dependent on people living forever. People can come, spend some time, get employed, do some work, get that satisfaction from working with the cows. So this is much more practical. But we don't have enough of it. It's a real, one of the areas, for example, we're hearing yesterday again about many things we're not doing as a society. We're not doing these Varnashram colleges. We also don't have enough cow protection. We don't have enough cows. Very, very few. We need more. Thousands of more cows. The manor itself needs at least 150. I did a study for Europe. It needs 1,000 cows in the whole of Europe. We have much, much less than that. I was doing a study in, I think I mentioned it last time, in India. And we calculated that for all the temples, just for the deities, we need 65,000 cows in our ISKCON Goshalas. Cows, calves, bulls and oxen. We have 3,000. No one's talking about it. No one's talking about integrating, scaling up cow protection to the level that we need. So these are challenges. These are challenges to reestablish these things. Trading, like in our movement, we hear about book distribution. We can live by book distribution, but actually very hard. When I was doing book distribution, I think I'd make 70 quid a day. You can't earn 70 quid a day and pay for your books and pay for your transport and have a happy wife. Not going to be possible. You need at least, I don't know, £25,000 a year to be a poor man in this country. It's going to cost you £1,000 a month for your house and another £1,000 to fill it up and feed it and have a car. £2,000 a month, or £24,000 to be a poor man. And that's after expenses, after taxes. So, you know, to make that amount of money to provide for your family, very, very hard to do it by book distribution. And therefore, we don't have many book distributors. We do have some, and they're very powerful. Whereas the average or below average, which I'm in the category, couldn't do it. I wish I could, but it just wasn't my ability, but some are doing it. So these things are there. But if you can make a living by your own business, you will find greater happiness. You'll feel more fulfillment because you're not dependent on the mercy of other people. So this is here we're now talking about the Brahmacharya life, we talk about Grihastha life. And then tomorrow we're going to talk about Vanaprastha answer yes. So any thoughts, comments, contributions? Govinda Brew. Some sound effects.
One again. Hare Krishna. Thank you. Thank you for the class and your analysing word for word, etc. I'm wondering, it seems to me, I'm just joining the dots here, if you look at this verse and then the next verse, so within the Varnashram system you've got four types of brahmachari, four types of, at least you have four types of vanaprastha, four types of sannyas, and these are all mentioned in these verses, and I'm assuming that the second half of today's verse is the four types of grihasthas. I know, for example, if you look in the Krishna book, I think it's described in the Krishna book that the Savitra is someone who's celibate for 3 days, and then the Prajapatya is someone who makes a vow to be celibate for a whole year. The next one is, I think it's called the Brahmachari, who does it until, or the Prajapatya, no, that's the other one, celibate for the duration of his study. Find Brahmachari. But I think in this particular verse, it's the Brihat, which means great. The great Brahmachari is someone who's lifelong Brahmachari, like, for example, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. And I'm also noticing that when you look at the sannyas categories and the vanaprastha categories, they seem to be progressing, one's higher than the other. So I'm wondering if these two verses are given the 16, the four subdivisions of the four ashrams, and then they're progressively higher. I'm wondering if that's the case, because maybe, but I don't see any progression with the grihastha. Maybe it's a case of varta, meaning you do business, which, but more announced is just to pick up the grains. And so it's kind of like, I think there's a progression in all these four subdivisions of the four ashrams. Just thinking, I'm not sure. But it's not very clearly delineated in this particular chapter.
I like what you said. No, thank you. Thank you very much. Another thing that came to mind is that sometimes, although I struggle with the word-for-word translations, as you described it, some things are just known and they have different terminologies. For example, you don't find the word bullock in the Sanskrit. You don't find the word castrated bull in Sanskrit. You get bull, calves, cows. But those who work with cows know you have to have bullocks. You have to have castrated bulls because it's not dangerous. So similarly, for the scholars of the Vedas, they would see those words in different ways. Even though the Sanskrit dictionary hasn't picked it up, they understand it in different ways. So thank you for that illumination. Any other things anyone wants to share? Any questions? Srinivas Prabhu.
So in England, how many cows do we have, like Leicester and then?
There are probably about 150, 180 protected cows in the UK, you could say. There's Leicester, I'm not sure they have 40. We have 70 here. There's a lady in South England who's got probably about 40. There's some in Glastonbury, he's probably about 10, like that. There's four in Innisrath. So that's kind of there are probably some other Hindu centres that have some. So you're talking about less than 200. Yeah, four or five. Srila Prabhupada told Dhananjaya we should have 150 cows. It wasn't specified cows, calves, bulls, and oxen. He said 150 cows. If we were to have 150 cows, all our milk, ghee, butter, yogurt, would be from our own cows. We wouldn't have to buy any milk from anywhere else. So Srila Prabhupada's figure is quite interesting. Anything? Govinda Guru?
So in the United Kingdom, our current government is very unpopular with farmers. because of this inheritance tax, and they're all up in arms. As looking at it from this perspective, in attack.
Well, it's interesting that, I mean, in our, what we're seeing here is that good government, Lord Brahma, he's creating this system. He's creating a way that vaishyas can flourish. So in our own society, ISKCON society, and we can look at what the world should do. We're not giving enough attention to this ourselves. We're not enabling devotees to flourish in this realm of farming either. It's not central attention. Building temples is very prominent. Giving out books is very prominent. Being an agriculturalist is not very prominent. No one's getting any prizes for being a good agriculturalist. But it could flip very quickly. Our movement could prioritize it, and then suddenly it become very prestigious, and it would turn things around. Because there's no shortage of resources. Realistically, whenever people attempt to establish farms, money flows in like a river. But they don't milk it. People are not milking it as well as they could. And so it's just a question of focus. So what we can get from it is our leaders, amongst all the other things they're looking at, this is also important. Lord Brahma's giving, you know, some verses here on its importance. So yeah, if the government, you know, they have their own reasons, but it's not based on initiation, it's not based on the Vedas, it's not based on celibacy, and therefore they don't really care about things. But we should care. We should, you know, we should try to establish a society where we're eating the best food. I mean, have you seen the crops they grow here? They get spinach. It's like this. It's just full of nutrients. It's full of prana. It's the best of food. We want to eat healthy, home-produced food. I'm just deciding. Okay, we'll, anything final? We'll end here.
Hare Krishna. I was just wondering what we can take away from this class, because it seemed like mostly you were saying that the methods described in this verse are highly impractical or not very understandable. But so how can we understand that Bhagavatam is also very relevant for us even nowadays?
Well, I think it is. In terms of these four, you could live like that. But you can't do it living in a 1,000 pound... Well, actually, no, let me say, you could actually do it. In this country, right now, you could live in any of these four. Because what you don't make up from your own, you could say, sales, the government will subsidize you with your housing and with your income. So it could be done. It's very practical. But will you be satisfied living like that? And again, as Guru is pointing out, each one of these are more and more difficult to do. Just to live by going around all the places of agriculture or what's been left behind, picking up and selling it. You could do that. But you'd have to be concomitantly satisfied with the revenue that comes from it. And that's a real Brahminical quality, to live with that. I'm satisfied. I don't need any more. But as soon as you're grihastha, the tendency for more is burning you all the time. My neighbor's got a car. I need a car. They're going to India every year. I need to go to India every year. Therefore, you need a certain amount of financial return. So all these are practical, but how are we aligned with it? So the verse one, Varta, some kind of business, is... I'm pointing out that in terms of cow protection, agriculture is difficult. But in terms of trade, you know, there's so many, most of our Vaishya community around here are trading something. So you could trade something and live. Because the other ones are practical. You can get initiated. You can also study the Vedas. And you can spend a certain amount of time living like a brahmachari. As Govinda was pointing out, there's four different periods of time. So that's all practical. Okay, we shall stop here. Srimad Bhagavatam ki.